You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1986 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother Tim Fagan on the subject, Song of Solomon.
Up to this point, we have tried to follow our procedure of looking at what the historical context is for the song, and the literary context, seeing how it's written and what form it takes. In the sheet on nuts and bolts, you'll find some of the things that can be put down as facts, and the content of the song that we can define, some more firmly than others. We will get to the application to ourselves later. But I want to review at this point the historical context that we have arrived at, and a bit of about the literary context too. We said that the song is set in the time of Solomon. And although we all have seen Solomon as a type of Jesus, in that he was the promised chosen son of all of the sons of David who reigned, that he was the one whom the Lord loved. He was the beloved of the Lord. And we have seen how that it was such a good start, his reign, such an excellent beginning. We've also seen, though, that he fell. And so Adam, he turns more into a type of Adam, perhaps, than of Jesus. An excellent beginning, but sin entered into the picture. Even perhaps in the taking of a Gentile bride, the daughter of Pharaoh. That could have been a very good thing, if we think about it. If we, say, look at the greater son of David, and see how he instructed his bride. Turn to John chapter 17 just for a moment. Think of how it could have been with Solomon and Pharaoh's daughter if he had followed the rightful direction that he should have as the husband, the one in charge, the one like Adam who was to have had dominion and to have instructed his wife and to have loved her and cared for her and directed her. John 17, verse 6. I have manifested thy name to the men whom thou gavest me out of the world. An echo? The woman whom thou gavest me. Adam confesses, she gave me of the fruit and I did eat. Here we have men who were to become the bride of Jesus, as we are, that God gave to him just as he gave Eve to Adam. But Jesus was the proper husband to that bride. Thine they were, and thou gavest them to me, and they have kept thy word. Now they know that everything that thou hast given me is from thee, for I have given them the words which thou gavest me. He instructed his bride. And they have received them, and know in truth that I came from thee. They have believed that thou didst send me. I am praying for them. I am not praying for the world, but for those whom thou hast given me, for they are thine. All mine are thine, and thine are mine, and I am glorified in them. And now I am no more in the world, but they are in the world, and I am coming to thee. Holy Father, keep them in thy name, which thou hast given me, that they may be one. Two flesh will become one flesh. That was the intent in the beginning, that the two would become one flesh, just as we are to become one to one another and one with Jesus, even as we are one. While I was with them, I kept them in thy name, which thou hast given me. I have guarded them, and none of them is lost but the son of perdition, that the scriptures might be fulfilled. So it could have been a very good thing, this taking of the Gentile bride from Egypt. If Solomon had been a man like Jesus, he asked for wisdom, and God gave that to him. God could not give him obedience. He had to generate that himself. We know this is true from our own experiences. I take it very seriously that tie in Mark chapter 10, which you don't need to turn to, where the rich young ruler came to Jesus and the Lord loved him. To me, that is a direction for us to say, well, here is Solomon, and it's just reenacted. And it's a commentary of inspired scripture on what Solomon's problem was, because the details seem to be piled up too much for it just to be coincident. He was a ruler, and he was young, and he was rich, and he had done everything. He had kept all the law. He was wise in that respect. And yet, his countenance fell, and he was sad. And that's exactly what I read when I read Ecclesiastes. The end of the life of a man in despair, because he knew the way of the Lord, he was wise, and yet he went a different way. He chose, his possessions were great as the rich young man's, and his countenance fell. He was unable to make the choice that he knew he should make, and at the end of his life, from what we read in Ecclesiastes, it's a tone of sadness. Countenance fell and he was sad. A tone of despair. All is vanity, nothing better, and to enjoy the fruit of your toil, eat, drink, because it's all vanity. Although there is wisdom in that book too, and advice and warning, a very sober warning from a man who knew. Not only did Solomon have great possessions, he had many wives, we've read, and he did fall, and that's our historical context. And I think that's the point at which we should look at Solomon. Not at the beginning, but Song of Solomon, we begin to interpret from the perspective after Solomon's death. Remember, it's a small point, but it could be very important, that we saw in chapter 6, the mention of the name Tirzah. And I went over this briefly before, but Tirzah is up near Jezreel. It's in the area in the northern kingdom, near Jezreel. Tirzah does not appear on this map. Jezreel and south of that, Tirzah would be in that area, north of Jerusalem, south of Jezreel. The point being that it was a very small village at the time of the empire of David and Solomon. 6 years after the ascension of Jeroboam to the throne of the northern kingdom, he established Tirzah as the capital of that northern kingdom. And so it does appear on this map of the kingdom of Israel and Judah. Okay? So it is true that Tirzah was a very insignificant, smallish village. Shechem was the first capital of Israel under Jeroboam, if I remember correctly. 6 years after his taking the throne, he established Tirzah as the capital. It flourished. It became a notable city, and it's shown on this map of that time period. And then under Omri, the capital was moved to Samaria. So there is a time when this description of Tirzah would have been possible to have been made in chapter 6, verse 4. You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love, comely as Jerusalem. Leading us to the point that the Song of Solomon seems most likely then to have been written by a northern prophet. Doesn't seem reasonable that now, after the division, at that time period when Tirzah was a city to be known of by those reading the book, If it were a southern prophet, poet, songwriter, that he would have used Tirzah because that represented apostasy. That represented the other side, the northern rebels who have left God. It'd be hard to imagine a southern Judean poet, just from a human point of view, comparing Jerusalem to Tirzah. Both of them as being beautiful. However, with tongue in cheek, a northern poet inspired by God, it leads us to this perspective of somebody from the north, possibly one of the prophets, or of the school of the prophets that Elijah came out of, who lived in the area north of Judah, in the southern part of the northern kingdom, keeping an eye on what was going on in both, looking down now from the perspective of after the division, looking back on the life of Solomon, and seeing it from that historical context that we have set of a man who fell away from the Lord. Now looking back at that time and from this northern point of view and the linguistic hints, the grammatical things, the dialectical things are supposedly another indication of that, that this is somebody from the north. But I think we should take it more than that. We take it as God's point of view. God is now telling us something about Saul and about that time. I want to read to you just a list. Here are some of the place names that are found in the Song of Solomon. Sharon, Bether, Lebanon, Gilead, Mount Hermon, which also has the Ammonite name Senir and the Assyrian name Amana. Tirzah is mentioned. Mahanaim, Heshbon, Bath Rabim, Carmel, Baal Haman, and Shulam. All of those names, it's quite a list, are all northern names, place names of the northern kingdom or associated with that area. In the south, the only two places we read of that are described by name are Jerusalem and En-Gedi. Okay, so there's another little lead. As we just read through, we pick out that the places that are talked about the most are up north. Just another hint that we have here, the product of a northern kingdom at a time after Solomon's death. And you might remember on the sheet the historical context that at the very bottom we had this quote. His heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord, as David his father had done. And I take that as the theme by which to interpret the Song of Solomon. That there is a tremendous contrast being shown between what Solomon did as compared to what his father David had done. To the way Solomon's heart was compared to the way that David wholly followed the Lord with all of his heart. That to me is the theme by which to interpret the song. So then, perhaps we could say it this way, that the purpose of the Song of Solomon was to contrast David and Solomon. That's the reason why it was given, and the reason why it's been kept for us down through the centuries. Because, as I would read it, and as many have read it, we looked at the interpretations of the song historically by the Jews, by the Christians, by Christadelphians, and typically it's been Solomon, Jesus, Shulamite, Israel, or Shulamite, the Ecclesia. But there have been people all along who have seen in the Song of Solomon three characters and have not followed that interpretation from early times. They've been in the minority. But there have always been some people who have seen in the book three characters and who see it as not flattering at all to Solomon. Who see it as an indictment of Solomon and Solomon representing the world. The flash, the glitter, the things of the world that attract the natural man. Okay? That's my perspective. In reading the Song of Solomon, I would see his speeches, as I encourage you to read on the nuts and bolts sheet, that the speeches of Solomon, maybe we could look at those now just for a few minutes. Chapter 1, verse 9. You might want to use your handout that's got the text on it to write notes on, because you do already have that marked as a speech of Solomon. We won't read it word for word, skim through, and you can see in chapter 1, verse 9 through 11 and 1:15, a description of the Shulamite. And she is described as beautiful, physically. Her cheeks, her neck. You are beautiful, my love. You're beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Okay? Skip to chapter 2, verse 2. As a lily among brambles, so is my love among maidens. Solomon is saying, you're prettier than all the rest. Chapter 4, first 7 verses on page 3. And again, we go through this description of how the Shulamite looks physically. Beautiful, beautiful. Your eyes, your teeth, your lips, your mouth, your cheeks, your neck, your breasts. All fair, verse 7. All fair, my love, no flaw. You're physically perfect. Chapter 6, verse 4. Solomon breaks in again. Beautiful. Tears of comely, and he goes through it again. Eyes, hair, teeth, cheek, and then tells her how much the other women in the court have praised her. Turn over, chapter 7, verse 1. Almost monotonous. As a matter of fact, to me it's an indication of the fact that these are well-used lines by the man, perhaps. I mean, this isn't the first time. If you've got 700 wives and 300 concubines, your feet, your thighs, your navel, your belly, your breasts, your neck, your eyes, your nose, your head, your hair, it's just the same all the way through. Physical description of her beauty, how she is perfect. And not to be compared. Now look back at chapter 2. And in chapter 2, verse 10, we know that the beloved is speaking. It says so, and that's a big help. So we can take the things that he says, the way he describes his love, and you will notice that every time he uses the phrase, my love, my love, he adds to it. Solomon used the same phrase, but he limited it always to Solomon say, my love. The beloved always adds to that phrase, as here, my love, my fair one. And you'll see that a number of times. And he says, arise, come away. Come away from where you are. You're in Solomon's court. We already know that. And he says, arise and come away. For the winter is past, flowers appear on the earth, the fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom, they give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. O my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, your face is comely. Catch us the little foxes, and so on. So there's a plea for her to do something. It's not just a description of how beautiful she is, foot to head. Turn over to chapter 4. And we see that same appeal to come away, to leave where she is. Come with me from Lebanon. And I suggest that Lebanon there is to be understood as page 3, chapter 4, verse 8. Lebanon meaning the house of Lebanon in Jerusalem, that great grandeur of the one of the palaces that Solomon built where they might have, that he might be referring to. Lebanon, the peak of Amana, the peak of Sinar and Hermon, the dens of lions, the mountains of leopards, could be a backward way of saying all that is represented there, the lions and the leopards, the princes, the royalty. And in this mountain place, only he uses the figures of Hermon. But he's saying the same thing. Come away from where you are. And notice in verse 9, not how beautiful she is, but you have ravished my heart. You have ravished my heart with a glance of your eyes. Sweet is your love. Better is your love than wine, and so on. And he describes her character, verse 12. A garden locked, not her physical beauty, but the way she is in her character. She is a garden locked. She's virtuous. She's chaste. Is my sister, my bride. And he calls her my bride. Solomon never attempts that. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. A garden fountain, verse 15, a well of living water. Her character, the way she was inside, not her physical beauty. Let's turn on over to chapter 8 and look at this last section briefly. Verse 13, I guess, is really all we should take time to look at right now. O you who dwell in the gardens, the beloved says to the Shulamite, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. He's wanting her to do something. He wants her to come away from Solomon. He wants to hear her voice. Let me hear it. Only Brother Roland Olson has come to me since the first day and asked me, well, are you going to tell us why it cost Adonijah his life when he asked for the hand of Abishag from Solomon? Turn back to 1 Kings chapter 1. Came to Bathsheba, asking Bathsheba to appeal to Solomon for the hand of Abishag, the Shunammite. I'm sure many of the rest of you have wondered that too, but Roland came to me and said, oh, we're gone. You're just going to leave that hanging? Or what? Well, now is the time when we want to start putting together what might have been actually going on that was the basis of this song. Try to imagine now the way it would have been for this beautiful maiden, verse 3 of 1 Kings 1. They sought for a beautiful maiden throughout all the territory of Israel, and found Abishag, the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The maiden was very beautiful, and she became the king's nurse and ministered to him, but the king knew her not. All right. Turn to chapter 2. And we saw this before, just going over it again. Verse 19, 18, 19, in that area. Solomon responds to his mother who has just asked for the hand of Abishag for Adonijah. Verse 22, King Solomon answered his mother, and why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also, for he is my older brother, and on his side are Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, God, do so to me and more also if this word does not cost Adonijah his life. Verse 25, so King Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck him down and he died. And as I mentioned the other day, he could have just said no, but he killed him. And I suspect it's because he saw in that request Adonijah's play for the kingdom, potentially. Because if you remember what happened in the rebellion of Absalom, when David fled Jerusalem and left his concubines behind, that was Absalom's way of establishing his claim to that throne, right? By taking those concubines in the sight of all Israel, David set them apart in a house apart when he did return to Jerusalem. So I think Solomon wisely saw in Adonijah's request, Adonijah's making a claim to the throne. Why? Because Abishag was technically one of David's wives. He was in the harem, so to speak, that Solomon would have inherited by right of those concubines, princesses. And in asking for Abishag, Adonijah sealed his death warrant. But it should lead us to then think about that, what the position would have been for this beautiful woman in the court of Solomon. Because, very important detail having to do with geography again, Shunem is the same place geographically as Shulam. The same place. It's two different ways of saying, probably a dialectical change, but it's, you can look up in any atlas and it will tell you that Shunem equals Shulam or Shulam equals Shunem. In the Septuagint, in Song of Solomon, when it mentions the Shulamite, she is called the Shunammite. In the Septuagint, it's that close of an identification. There is an overlap there. So that the Shulamite that we read of in the Song of Solomon, that could easily be also have been expressed as the Shunammite. Abishag, the Shunammite. Right? That's who we first read about. Chapter 1, verse 3. They sought for a beautiful maiden throughout all the territory of Israel and found Abishag, the Shunammite, from Shunem, from northern Israel. Northern Israel. And so think how appropriate her character would have been for someone now after Solomon's death to take and to build a song around, inspired by God, to take her position there in the court, what it would have been like for her, this northern maiden, and use her to express a unwillingness to be taken by Solomon, to become part of Solomon's harem, one of his wives, to be approached by her, by him, and tried to be won over by all that Solomon represented, the world. But to refuse that, because she represented loyalty to David. Because, beloved, as you probably know, in Hebrew, is David's name. That's what his name means in Hebrew. And when we read in the Song of Solomon, my beloved, that could be understood as my David, technically. It's more easily translated as my beloved, but it's the same Hebrew letters. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. I am my David's. My David is mine. And so what we, I think, have in this song is a wonderful picture of a woman who loved her David, King David, who ministered to him, who lay in his bosom, who saw in him all that was good. This was a man after God's own heart. He represented the true worship of God, a man whose heart was right before God, who had the right spirit, who sinned, but who was God's man. A woman who was faithful to God's man and loved him. Now he's dead, and he's gone. And she seeks to find him, but he's gone. Solomon breaks in, tries to woo her, and we can see how this builds as we look at the historical background of it and what a poet would have been trying to do with it. He's trying to teach Israel, I think, that you have fallen away from God. You've left David, the beloved of God, who should be your beloved, and you have gone after Solomon, you daughters of Jerusalem. But this Shulamite, no, her love was stronger than death. She will be reunited with her beloved because of her faithfulness to what he represents, because of her love for him. Look at that chapter 8 again. She says, after all of the trial, after all of the attempts by Solomon to woo her over with these flattering speeches, she says in verse 10, I was a wall, my breasts were like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one who brings peace. Solomon had a vineyard. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, my integrity, is my very own, is for myself. You, O Solomon, you can have all the world. She says to her beloved, verse 6, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death. Strong as death. So we get this picture of a woman, a beautiful woman, Abishag, who is faithful to her, David, even though he's dead. And her love that she had for him was stronger than death. It was a flame of God himself that burned in her because of what he represented to her. She withstood all of the blandishments of Solomon. And she was eventually reunited with her beloved. Look at verse 5. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? And of course, we think forward to how the Shulamite really represents all of us. If we are the true Israel, faithful to the greater David, the beloved Son of God, our beloved, now gone, in faith we have to be patient and wait for him. He's absent from us, and we seek him. But if we have that kind of love, then that will overcome even death itself. Our death, his death, and there will be a uniting of the Shulamite with her beloved coming up from the wilderness. There's more, but I'll say that for tomorrow. We will see what the application might be further beyond now having pieced together a skeleton of what could have been behind the song itself. But be thinking also now of the application. Inspired scripture has an application. Brother Harry, in his book Exploring the Bible, which I think is one of those required reading type books, for any of us who would want to become Bible students, says, always look for two people in the Scriptures, for Jesus and for yourself. As we try to apply what we can begin to pick out of the Song of Solomon, we should apply it then to how do we see in that Jesus? And finally, what lessons, what applications are there for ourselves? Let me read to you from chapter 3. And just by reading, I hope that it will set your mind working now as to how this fits. This whole picture now in our heads, we look at the text and we say, how does that fit with Jesus? How will it fit with me? Chapter 3, verse 1. Upon my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. He's been gone. She has sought him. She didn't find him. She called him, but he was gone. Now, verse 4, scarcely had I passed these watchmen when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go till I had brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her that conceived me. Chapter 5, verse 1. The beloved speaks to the Shulamite. He says, I come to my garden, my sister, Adelphos, Septuagint word there, or the feminine form of it, my bride, I gather my myrrh with my spice. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. I drink my wine with my milk. She describes what happens. Then, verse 2, I slept, but my heart was awake. She said, hark, my beloved is knocking. He says, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. Her shepherd has been out in the night. She says, I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh, upon the handles of the bolts. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me. They wounded me. They took away my mantle, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. After describing her beloved to these daughters of Jerusalem, in verse 2 of chapter 6, in response to the question of now these, and notice this very striking thing, chapter 6, verse 1, after having been given a description, oh, and by the way, look at chapter 5, verse 10. As she begins to describe her beloved, she says he is all radiant and ruddy. Who is it that we think of when we hear the description of ruddy? Right. Distinguished among 10,000. Saul has slain his thousands. David his 10,000. On down, then, after describing his beauty, they are moved to ask her in verse 1 of chapter 6, whither has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Whither has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? now. It's a complete change. At first, perhaps keep your finger there, turn back to chapter 1. Such a remarkable change. She's in the court of Solomon. She tries to de-emphasize her own beauty. Chapter 1, verse 5. I'm dark, but comely. But I'm swarthy. Do not gaze at me. The sun has scorched me. My mother's sons made me a keeper of vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. At that point, it doesn't seem like it to her because of where she is, assailed by Solomon. Tell me, then, she cries out to her absent beloved, tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon. For why should I be like one who wanders beside the flocks of your companions? They say, now she has just cried out to her beloved, although absent, and asked, where are you? Tell me where you are. I want to come away. I want to go with you where your flocks are. Why should I be like one who is veiled? You might find in your own Bible there. And here's an implication. It was a harlot who was veiled at that time, who followed the flocks of the shepherds, who, like Tamar, requested a kid as a pledge, as payment from Judah. It was a harlot who was veiled. Why should I be like a harlot in this court? Tell me where you are that I may come to you and leave this place. Scornfully, I suggest, in verse 8, they reply, if you do not know, O fairest among women, go, follow in the tracks of the flock and pasture your kids beside the shepherd's tent. That's what you want. Go, leave the court. They have just described verses, into verse 4, the excellence of Solomon's love. They tell her very scornfully, go on, find your beloved. They later ask him, what is your beloved more than another, pointedly. Now they're getting the picture, and after the description, they say in chapter 6, verse 1, whither has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? They're ready to follow her now back to the beloved. Okay? I didn't get to finish, but the sequence ends in one last place. Chapter 6, verse 11. After she describes her beloved, they ask where he is. Solomon breaks in one time here, his next to the last speech, but she says in verse 11, I went down. I think we're trying to take present application and application to Jesus. I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom before I was aware. It's that same suddenness that we read in chapter 3. Right after she left the watchman, she found him. She held him. Before I was aware, my fancy set me in a chariot beside my prince. Okay, we'll take up there tomorrow.